You're listening to The Narrow Mind. This is show number 931, which is part 5 in our series of the critique on Christopher Hitchens' book. Our in-studio guest today is Mr. Paul Minotta.
Coming to you live from our studios in Southern California, Real Christianity in the Real World, The Narrow Mind.
And I hope you've learned something tonight, because you've got a lot of learning to do.
I've learned once again that the atheist can't account for morality. That's what I've learned.
Oh, are you kidding?
Do you sin as a Christian?
Please know that there are different degrees of sin. Worry.
Oh, okay.
Sin. I do.
You're
worry.
A Roman Catholic.
I'm answering your question.
Okay, so obviously you didn't get all the Roman Catholicism out of your system when you claim to have been born again.
And now our host, Gene Cook Jr.
Hello, everyone. Welcome to another edition of The Narrow Mind on this Saturday evening at... did you hear that? That was kind of weird.
I think I just pressed something.
I think what it is that microphone right there actually picks up the air conditioning more than this one does.
Oh,
more than these two do.
So if I go like...
Yeah, I'm not sure why.
Curious.
Yeah, there is this... Yeah, why would that microphone be more sensitive than these two?
I don't know.
I don't know either.
Maybe because I'm softly spoken.
You know what? You might have something there.
Yeah, that might be the case.
And because... You don't talk into the microphone, and so we have to crank up the volume on the screen.
Because I like to look at people when I'm talking to them.
Yeah, you can't look at us when you talk.
That's right.
You have to look straight ahead.
Yeah,
straight ahead.
Just cold, you know, straight ahead look.
There you go. Now, this is a special time slot for us. Normally, we broadcast in the morning at 9 a.m. on Saturday morning, and we moved the show to 5 p.m. on the West Coast. And we did that for a reason. Because the new love of my life, no, I didn't get divorced and... met some chick on the internet on eHarmony. No, the new love of my life, Torque, my dog, who's 8 weeks old today, had his ears cropped today. And so I wasn't able to do it. And so in addition to not being able to do the show this morning, I've got him right now sitting in studio with us. I need to keep a close eye on him because the rest of the family is not here. And so I'm going to be in and out of this broadcast, I'm sure. And at some points, I'm going to turn it over just to Paul and Jonathan. Paul, welcome once again to the studio.
Thank you.
And we're going to be continuing our discussion on Christopher Hitchens' book, Why God Is Not Great. This is actually part 5 in the series. And I'm just going to allow Paul to jump in where he wants. We've got a lot of material to cover today. We're actually going to do we're going to attempt to do 2 full hours. And so if you've got the time, how does that saying go? If you've got the time?
I don't believe I've heard that one.
Yeah. I can't think what it... There was like a jingle for a commercial.
You've got
never heard of it. We've got the...
It mustn't have reached the British shores.
If anybody out there sends me an email before the show's over and tells me what that jingle was, and hopefully it'll ring a bell and I'll be able to affirm that that's what it was, I will give you a 1-year free subscription to the Narrow Mind Archive. All right, so at this point we're going to allow Paul Minotta to take over. And he's going to jump in. And what chapter are we in now of the book, Paul?
Chapter 3. It's a short digression on the pig.
Mm-hmm. A short digression on the pig? You mean it's autobiography?
Remember what we said about the ad hominem?
Oh, I'm sorry. I did. If you do a search, go to google.com. Do a search for Christopher Hitchens. There's a picture of him smoking a cigarette in the shower. Have you seen that one?
No, can't say that I have.
Yeah, I'm happy to say I have not seen that picture.
Yeah, it's let's talk about chapter four.
No, chapter 3.
Chapter 3. I'm sorry, part 5, chapter 3. Mm-hmm. All right, where do you want to start, Paul?
Well, I've marked off again some areas for Jonathan to read, and it's a pretty short chapter. I think it's only about 3 or 4 pages long, and
right.
You just have a couple points to hit in this chapter. And then we'll move on to the next one. So, Jonathan, you can just begin reading there.
Yeah, the first paragraph of chapter 3. It says, all religions have a tendency to feature some dietary injunction or prohibition.
Whether it is the now lapsed Catholic injunction to eat fish on Fridays, or the adoration by Hindus of the cow as a consecrated and invulnerable animal, or the refusal by some other Eastern cults to consume any animal flesh, or to injure any other creature, be it rat or flea.
Yeah, and so to some of that I want to just say, big deal. You know, so does the FDA. They have certain dietary injunctions. Doctors, when dealing with a patient who is at risk for a heart attack, they also tell the patient what they can and can't eat, or what they should and shouldn't eat. So I'm not really clear what he thinks is special about religion here. I assume that Hitchens would ban the practice of eating live human flesh as well, and since he would ban, and that would be a dietary injunction.
Mm-hmm.
And as far as Christianity goes, there's no dietary injunction imposed by us that I'm aware of. I mean, besides what Hitchin would agree with, we wouldn't say that you can run up and take bites out of people and eat them.
Yeah, that's wrong. Okay. If somebody's wrestling with that, okay, it's wrong to do that. I'm talking to the dog.
Yeah. We might want to let him know.
Yeah. He mentions that tradition in the Catholic Church. And that's an extra-biblical tradition. So there's nothing he can pin on the Bible. He can't pin any errors on the Bible, showing that Christians impose some sort of dietary injunction. So I'm not really clear what he's trying to say, because he said all religions do this. And not only that, the claim he makes about the Hindus is likewise pretty ignorant. I'm not a Hindu myself, but at least I can afford them the proper respect of characterizing, you know, their position correctly, which Hitchens seems to be unable to do. I'm assuming that Hitchens doesn't think that it's okay to eat our grandmothers.
And yes, I would like to think so, Mr. Hitchens.
And I think us here in the studio agree, and we don't think we should eat our grandmothers as well. This is why the Hindu doesn't eat the cow, and why Eastern religions don't harm other animals. Quite simply, they believe them to be grandma.
Yes.
Okay, so we believe that they're wrong. They have
Speak for yourself, man.
We believe they have their facts
My
wrong.
My grandma's not a cow. Some of my friends believe that, but... Not me.
I thought that might be a catalyst.
I came to America.
Yeah, I thought that might be a catalyst to one or two jokes.
Okay.
The accent I was anticipating.
I think you have, don't you have lined up a guest from India that's going to be calling in when we're done with this series, Gene?
Yeah, I'm trying to remember what his name is. I have it written down here somewhere.
Ethan Wist.
Ethan Wist, that's right. Yeah.
We look forward to that.
Yeah, Ethan Wist.
Well,
sorry. Puts Jay Walker to shame.
They're not saying something.
He wants to talk about why good is not great. I'm not sure what he means by that, but we'll find out.
I'm excited. Hindus, what I was mentioning there, we disagree with them as far as the facts go. We don't agree that the cow is grandma. So we believe that they're wrong as far as this goes. But we have what ethicists call here a disagreement of fact, and not a disagreement in moral belief. See, Hitchens just doesn't even seem to be able to think in these categories. He doesn't seem like he's, read very deep into the literature to be able to understand what he's trying to object to. Hitchens doesn't think we should eat grandma. And so if the Hindus are correct that the cow is grandma, or that certain animals are, grandma and grandpa and past uncles, if they're correct in that, then Hitchens would agree that we shouldn't eat them. So we have, as I said, a disagreement in fact, not moral belief. So,
yeah, in fact, I would argue that it's the Christian who has the most liberty when it comes to food choice. Because, as you know, a lot of imposed governmental dietary laws prohibit the consumption of certain types of meat. You can't eat that meat's contaminated. And I don't know the name of this organisation, but I think there is an organisation in England.
PETA?
What's that? Is it PETA?
I don't know, is it?
Yeah, I don't know. Maybe it is, maybe it isn't. So maybe somebody can Google it.
People for Ethical Treatment of Animals, PETA.
Is that what it is?
Yeah.
Who really seek to enforce these laws.
which will protect animals, restrict what type of meats and foods we eat. But when you look at the ministry of Christ, did he not pronounce all foods as clean?
Yeah, he did. Even KFC.
Even KFC, and that's saying something. If that can be sanctified through prayer, as Timothy says.
It's not what goes in a man that makes him unclean.
That's right. True Christian liberty there.
Right, and that's what I mentioned earlier. It's, where is he getting this idea as far as Christianity goes? And I was alluding to the fact that all foods that Jesus declared that wall of partition down, and the food's clean now. And so this is just a frustrating thing in reviewing this book. It's just littered with these kinds of sophomoric and ignorant claims. I'm here having to defend the Hindu for Hitchens because he's so ignorant and uninformed about what Hindus think.
And we thank you. I'm sorry. I couldn't resist.
Go.
That was anyway, Hindus, brothers and sisters, I want to represent the British political correct type of position right now. I do apologize.
I'm sorry. Yeah.
But you were saying...
Well, I was saying it's just basically one sweeping generalization after another. It's characterized. His book is characterized by unargued bias as it moves, you know, from one rant to the next, and without he seems to have no care for any details or subtleties in the subjects that he's taken upon himself to write on, and to point out these kind of, you know, stupid statements would be, all throughout the book, would be a Herculean task, and just don't have time to do that in every single chapter. So I'll maybe make a few of these remarks here and there, but I just want to let you know that the book is riddled with these sorts of errors, and I've at least touched on one of them at every show that we've done to show you, but there's a lot more in the book.
Mm-hmm. Now, Paul, maybe you're going to talk about this, I'm not sure, but I think that part of the problem is that atheists commonly believe, wrongly, that if it's in the Bible, because we take the Bible as one book, as Revelation that contains 66 books, but we take it as a volume, that because it's in the Old Testament, then that somehow causes it to be binding for us as Christians. And so I think this is probably his fundamental error. Well, it's in the Bible that you shouldn't eat, you know, pork.
Yeah, we're going to touch a little bit more on that a little bit later. But more specifically as we get down the road, when he specifically states that's what he's doing. He's in later chapters, he specifically says that Christian, if it's in the Bible, you need to be practicing it right now. And Christians who don't are just basically like liberals. And they don't take their Bible seriously. Mm-hmm. So that will be touched on later, okay. And that is the categories that he's thinking in on certain points.
Yeah. Do you want me to continue?
Theonomic atheists.
That's interesting. So you've highlighted another passage here. This is on page 38, beginning at the bottom of that page. And it reads, "I hope that you have guessed by now that we know in any case that this fine beast is one of our fairly close cousins. It shares a great deal of our DNA, and there have lately been welcome transplants of skin, heart valves, and kidneys from pigs to humans. If, which I hardly trust, does not happen, a new Dr. Moreau could corrupt recent events in cloning and create a hybrid, a pigman is widely feared as the most probable outcome."
Pigman.
Yeah.
Wow.
Yeah, well, here, this chapter's on the pig, and Hitchens is trying to explain. He, from the initial, the first sentence Jonathan read, he leaps from that to discuss particularly the pig and Christianity or Judaism's views on the pig. So he starts to specifically speak on the pig, and the section Jonathan read is where he says that we have a lot in common with the pig, and DNA-wise, and we're going to have successful transplants now and in the future, having to do with the pig. Well, what I want to point out here mainly, though, is that he tips his hand a bit, and he shows us that he presupposes that man is different in degree and not in kind from all of other things here on Earth. It's just a difference in other words, he believes that man is only quantitatively different from all other life, not qualitatively.
Right.
And so, and this observation will come in handy down the road as well as we interpret some of the things that he says. His view here is going to weigh in on that. But in anticipating some future objections that we'll be giving down the road in the book, a few of the problems that this view entails is that it makes it hard to argue for how any real dignity is had by man. How does some reconfiguration of matter or of a more complex structure of some basic, you know, stuff all of a sudden make dignity appear? Now, how do rights that we have come about? Do they just pop into existence when the right chemicals are arranged? Because that's all that we have that's different from us and animals, just a certain different recombination or a more complex structure of some chemicals and molecules. And so how does dignity and moral rights come about just because you make something, you reconfigure some of the same stuff differently? How is man, you know, the bearer of moral status by just a different arrangement of stuff? How does intentionality, that's a basic feature of consciousness, and it's a precondition of intelligibility, intentionality, that's our thoughts basically to something, our thoughts directed towards something. When you have an intentional conscious state, could be I desire to drink my soda. That's just what's called an intentional state. How does that arise? Just from a different combination of non-intentional stuff from that the pig's composed of. So if intentionality can't be made intelligible on his view of persons, then Hitchens's very claim here is self-refuting, since it's an intentional claim. He has a mind, a state of mind that's representing the world in some way, i.e., in this scenario, we are composed of just a little bit more different arrangement, but fairly close to that of the of DNA to that of the pig. So that's what's called an intentional stance that he has going on here. And if he can't account for that, as I'll try to argue later, intentionality cannot arise on this view. If he can't account for that, then this very claim of his won't make sense. No material thing has intentionality intrinsically in itself. And almost all materialists would agree with me on this. And so these are the kinds of problems that Hitchens doesn't even bother to deal with in this book, and I doubt he's even aware of them. And then as far as what Jonathan just read, I should point out, I don't know if you guys caught this too, when he commented about Dr. Moreau, and that he hopes that never happens, that this pig man doesn't come about. Well, what's Hitchens doing hindering science in the name of ethics?
Right.
You know, if science wants to make a pig man, why stop the progress? This, you know, quest for knowledge. He's acting like a, you know, fundamentalist, anti-scientific Puritan who wants to keep man in the Dark Ages.
Yeah, be a free thinker, man.
Yeah. If there's no God...
The pig man. Be a free thinker, man. The pig man.
Right. What basis does he have to hinder scientific progress? If there's no God, I want to see this before I die. I want to see a man crossed with a three-toed sloth. Or, you know, perhaps a real-life mermaid.
Mm-hmm.
And maybe even a cross between a donkey and Hitchens.
Maybe the Chronicles of Narnia might one day be a reality.
Right. Yeah. And so what is... I just want to know, throughout the book, Hitchens blames Christians for trying to halt the progress of science. For example, when we try to halt stem cell research in the name of our ethics. Well, what's he doing here trying to hinder science in the name of ethics?
Yeah. So, I want to be on my best behavior here.
Are you really?
That's right, you're going to.
Just happened to find this wave of Porky the Pig. I think this would be an example of the pig man. This isn't even anything new either.
Yeah. So, moving on. Well, actually, no, because we're still talking about pigs. It says, I'm on page 40 here, halfway down the first paragraph. It says, the eating of pig flesh was considered as something special, even privileged and ritualistic. This mad confusion between the sacred and the profane is found in all faiths at all times. The simultaneous attraction and repulsion derive from an anthropomorphic root. The look of the pig, and the taste of the pig, and the dying yells of the pig, and the evident intelligence of the pig, were too uncomfortable reminiscent of the human. Porcophobia and porcophilia, those are actual words apparently, those probably originate in a nighttime of human sacrifice, and the even cannibalism at which the holy texts often do more than hint.
Right. Interesting.
Well, note here that that what he's trying to do is give a naturalistic explanation for the Israelite injunction against eating pig. And that's what these guys do, the guys like Hitchens, atheists, naturalists, materialists. Either they can explain every phenomena in terms of basic laws of physics, or they can't. If they can't, then they eliminate those things from their ontology. That's what you have to do. You have to go about to every phenomenon and give it a naturalistic explanation, you know, an earthly explanation. And so that's what he's trying to do here. He's trying to be a good scientist and show all his buddies how he can give his own naturalistic interpretation of these events. Now, so he can't deny that the Old Testament has these injunctions against eating swine. And so, given his... Then what he has to do is give a naturalistic account of how that practice arose. And since God, as we'll see later as we progress in the book, since God isn't a useful hypothesis, you can't boil God down to protons and neurons and atoms and things like that, he can't use God in his naturalistic analysis, obviously, to explain all the relevant data. So he doesn't have any need for the God hypothesis, and what he has to do is then give a naturalistic account. So that's basically his basic program of what he's trying to do here. And as with last week, I have to cover parts of his own argument that he leaves out. So last week I had to help Hitchens out make him familiar with his own side of the debate and how he has to be an evolutionist in his analysis of wars and violence. And this week I'm going to have to explain his own side and what he's doing here, because he leaves that silent. I'm going to have to explain that for everyone and shore up his own side of the debate. So do you guys know, Gene and Jonathan, you guys know what it is to give a scientific or a naturalistic explanation of some event?
I've got a good idea, but I think you could expound upon it for us. Gene?
Of an event?
Of some event. Yeah, just like your CD sitting there.
You would have to say it was based upon
the
some
table.
Antecedent stimuli or some antecedent...
No, I don't. I'm going to have to go with no.
Yeah.
Well,
maybe no. Might be
I'm the dumb one here.
Okay. Well,
I represent our listeners. No, I'm just kidding.
There's a lot of disagreement.
At least the atheist.
Yeah, I didn't say that.
Yeah, you have fun today, aren't you, Gene?
See, this is what happens when we schedule the show at 5 p.m. I'm wide awake. I just drank a Diet Coke, got a little caffeine rush, feeling good, took a shower. I'm feisty.
You're good to go, Gene.
So. And I'm humble.
I'm humble, too. And that's why we like you.
Why don't you explain to us, Paul?
All right, well, there's disagreement among some naturalistic philosophers here, but what I think I'm about to say is pretty fair. I think they could agree with most of it. As the Encyclopedia of Philosophy states, naturalists repudiate the view that there could exist any entities or events which lie in principle beyond the scope of scientific explanation. So naturalists, for example, that naturalist David Papineau believes that a robust naturalism holds a commitment to the completeness of physics such that a purely physical specification of the world plus physical laws will always explain what happens. Okay, this account will not include reference to mental entities that are not identical to or realized by certain non-mental properties. This view of reality here, they view it as consisting of nothing but a spatiotemporal system.
Right.
And that system is closed. Nothing, not part of that system, can cause anything in that system to occur. And this is why some naturalists might even say, hey, maybe a God might exist. But he's just outside of the this closed system here, so he's totally irrelevant to anything, even if he did exist. So sometimes when you call naturalists atheists, they might say, well, that's a straw man. We're not really atheist. God could exist for all we know. Or naturalism doesn't entail atheism because he could exist for all we know. But for the most part, they are atheists, and their position does entail it. Okay, so what is this basic stuff that everything's made of that is used to explain any event by? It's not, much to your surprise, it's not the stuff like rocks and trees, tables and chairs and things like that. In one sense, none of these things exist as we observe them. Okay, all of those things have been explained as ultimately being a collection of molecules, atoms, electrons, protons, quarks, etc. So tables, chairs, trees, rocks, and the like, they're all made up of colorless, odorless, tasteless particulars. And so actually, the world that we see isn't anything like the world that we see in the common sense observation of it, isn't anything like how physics tells us things really are.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, so the table here in our studio, this one right in front of us in the studio, it seems impenetrable to our hands. Okay, it seems like it's a solid object, and it doesn't seem anything like a cloud. Yet that's what science tells us, that it tells us that a cloud is pretty much exactly what this table is.
Mm-hmm.
It's a cloud of unobserved particulars, each occupying less space than exists between them.
That's interesting. If you don't mind me having a comment there or a question,
yeah.
It reminds me a bit of the philosopher Leibniz, who believed that everything was all these particulars called monads.
Yeah, he did believe that. But I mean, you have guys like Democritus, even the Greek philosopher who was a materialist that just believed only atoms existed.
Right, and then you had others as well who would say all is one. And I don't know how, based upon this naturalism, that you can, how you can avoid that conclusion of monistic oneness, because if it's essentially made of the same...
Well, they do, and that's what Hitchens said earlier. Remember, he just said, hey, I'm basically the same stuff as a pig, I'm just
right.
Arranged differently.
Right.
So there's no qualitative difference. But here, they're going to say particles. So these particular things, they're particles, molecules, atoms, quarks, protons, things like that. They basically, as I said, they each one takes up less space than the space between them. And so this table here, it's apparently, to us, solid and impenetrable, but it's mostly empty space, actually. So science has actually taught that our senses are basically wrong, okay? In the sense that we see colors and smell smells and feel texture and have auditory experience. This is largely wrong in the sense that it's not the touchstone of reality. The touchstone is the world of unobserved entities mentioned, the ones I mentioned above. And so what we're doing here is what physicists and scientists call reductionism. Okay, and this table here that's in front of us again, it's nothing but a collection of particles, and the appearance that it is something other than this is simply an illusion. So its properties are likewise reduced. Its properties are things like its brown color, right? Its shape, its hardness, the sound when our fingers rap on it. So when Gene is sitting here feeling the table or resting his elbows on it and feeling its solidity, that's not something inherent in the table apart from Gene's touching it. All it is a state of the tables that the table's molecules happen to be in when the field of force they generate repel the field of force associated with that other collection of colorless, odorless, tasteless particles, Gene's elbows. And so it's not something
it was actually my hand.
Inherent in here in the table. It's just your force field is being repelled by this force field, and that's why it feels solid, but solidity is not part of the table. Okay, so everything real can be so reduced in this way. And if it can't be, well, then it's just not real. Okay, so in continuing in this all too brief romp through the naturalist procedure, I should point out then that it follows from the above that only objective, third-person observational explanations of events suffice. That's getting to what I was talking about, the scientific explanation. Third-person, objective, mind-independent explanations. Only those work. Any consideration of ultimately and irreducibly subjective first-person accounts are not allowed. Okay, and to a certain extent, we would say, hey, for scientists, this makes sense. In a certain way, we would say that because when the scientist wants to give a scientific explanation of, say, hot or cold, he can't rely on private, subjective reports, right? If you stick your hand in freezing water, really, really cold, if you went up to Antarctica and stuck your hand in that water, it would feel like it's burning you. It would feel hot. And if you take it out and stick it in lukewarm water, it still feels hot for a little while. Or if your left hand went into a warm bucket of water and your right hand, say, went into a cool bucket, and then you pulled them both out and stuck them in a middle bucket filled with lukewarm water, your left hand would still feel warm and your right hand would still feel cool. And so there could also be things like aliens out there, maybe, you know, for just sticking with the thought experiment here, that feel they feel as cold what we feel as hot. So to get at what hot and cold really is, the scientist can't rely on these subjective accounts. And heat, for example, is defined or redefined, if you will, and if you think that heat is inherent in things, in terms of objective mind independent facts, okay, facts about mean kinetic energy and the like. And these objective mind independent facts are simply all there is to the matter. So remember, the real world is simply colorless, odorless, tasteless, and we can add also that it's purposeless in the sense that of teleology. It's meaningless as well. Nothing is intrinsically meaningful. That is, nothing bears meaning in and of itself. There may be what some naturalists and physicalists call derived meaning or as if meaning, but there's nothing irreducibly meaningful. So we might apply some meaning to a painting, but there's no meaning in and of itself in the reality, because the odorless, colorless, tasteless particles, they don't bear meaning. They don't have meaning in and of themselves. So the meaning we would apply would be derived meaning. Okay, and so that's something like, a whirlwind tour through the naturalist program of explaining any and all phenomena. Okay, so it follows from the above that if something, what I said earlier, if that is something is irreducibly meaningful or subjective, and I should just make a clarification, subjective here simply means only directly verifiable by a subject, okay, not in the sense that it's relative. So subjective means it's directly verifiable by you, the subject.
Right. Okay. You are the one who experiences it.
Right.
You are the one that observes it.
But that's true. It's true nonetheless, and it's true objectively in the sense that it's not something that's true just because you want it to be true or you wish it to be true. So it's just some sort of a fact that is directly observed or experienced or evidenced by you. Other people would have indirect evidence for it. Now, there's some feature of common sense that cannot be reduced to the above type explanation. And common sense would be like, my Mountain Dew bottle here is green; it looks green, okay. But they would reduce that. So basically, if something can't be reduced to the above type situation I've set up, then it basically gets eliminated. So it's sort of as if you packed a suitcase, okay, and you try to shove in as much as possible into that suitcase. And we'll even suppose maybe you had to sit on it to get all this stuff that you wanted in there, or jump up and down on it to get as much in there as you could, and then you finally close it, and some pant legs and shirt sleeves are hanging out of it after you close it. Well, one response would be to say, oh, well, I guess I can't fit everything in this suitcase. So I better open it and rearrange it and or get a bigger suitcase or rethink my whole program here. Another response, though, would be to take out your scissors and cut right around the suitcase and say, well, see, everything fits. So in other words, you just eliminate everything that can't fit into your suitcase. Okay, so on this view here, the naturalist that I've been explaining, the naturalist has this view of the world, and anything's real has to ultimately be constituted of this objective, third person, colorless, odorless, tasteless particles. And if something ultimately isn't, if you find some event that, in common sense, world, say the color of green or whatever, and it can't be reduced to that, then you simply say, well, then it must not be real. I would eliminate it. Now, we don't have time to get much further into all this, and it was a short intro in it, and there are arguments given by many in the philosophy of mind or in the field of ethics and the field of metaphysics, the ones that I was bringing up, and these people are not all atheists either. Or not all theists, excuse me, these philosophers of mind and the ethicists and metaphysicians, and they would say that there are features of the world that do not fit into that naturalist suitcase that I mentioned earlier. And so I'll offer some real brief reasons why. Okay, basically it seems that this is just part of the essence, that part of the essence or intrinsic nature of, let's say, our mind, is that it has subjective features in the sense that I was just explaining it in. My experience of colors and my felt pain, my feel of pain, are not things that are objective and mind independent. Okay, there's a certain what philosophers call what it is like. Okay, there's a certain what it is like for me to be in pain. When I am in pain or I experience a red flash go by me or the greenness of the Mountain Dew, it's not as if a scientist can crawl inside my head and see the what it is like for me to feel the pain or experience that flash of red. Now, and this isn't to deny that he won't observe any neural activity, for example, but the description of that will never, ever include the quote-unquote what it is like for me to be in a state of pain. You can't pinpoint the pain. You can't touch anything and say, aha, that's the pain. And there's a sense that I experience this pain. I, as a unified center of consciousness or right. seat of experience, I experience this pain. There's not one little part in me that you can point to and say, that's the part that experiences pain. It just seems like I do. And so there's also a unity to the conscious experiences we have. And I have direct evidence or experience of these things. And these things now, I'll quit calling them these things, are feel of stuff, right? The feel of the solidity of the table, are seeing green, the color green. That's called qualia. Okay, that's what they call that in the literature. And I have direct access to this. No one else does. You may have indirect evidence of my being in pain. For example, I might jump and shout after I slam my hand in the car door, but that's all you have access to. So I could be acting, as far as you know. And besides that, you still can't observe the what it is like for me to be in pain. At best, you reason inductively from what it is like for you to be in pain to what it must be like for me to be in pain. But that private subjective experience that I have is something only I have access to. It's only something accessible to me, not to you. You'll never know what it's like for Paul to be in pain unless you were me. Okay? So there's a few arguments for this, and I'll run through a couple real quickly here. One's developed by Ned Block. It's called the Chinese Nation Argument. And simply put, the argument takes a common materialist understanding of the mind, one that tries to reduce the above seemingly private and subjective experiences and direct evidence to simply the communication of cells to nerves and neurons. And of course, all of that is observable via third person, right? A scientist could see your cells working in your neurons. And so this materialist view reduces everything to just the communication of all of that, all of your conscious experiences, just these cells communicating back and forth. And it is something observable. This is what's called the functionalist account of the mind. And it's probably the most popular materialist theory of the mind today. And it claims basically that mental states are defined simply in terms of their causal relation. Okay, that's it. And the upshot of this is that for the functionalist need not identify the mind with the brain. Okay, the identity theory of the mind, that would be that the one that identifies the mind with the brain, says they're identical. The mind is the brain. That has major problems, and functionalism seems to avoid those problems. So entities other than the brain could fulfill the requirements. Remember, this is just a certain, all you have to do is have a certain cause and effect relationship going on. It doesn't necessarily have to be that it's neurons. Okay, so a computer could fulfill these requirements, or even aliens who don't have anything like what we call brains that are in us. They don't even have brains. Say they have some other thing in their body that's not a brain, but they're still conscious and they see colors and stuff like that. As long as they those states represent the same cause and effect feature, it's, as long as they function in that way, then it can be said that they have a mind. Okay, so basically what Block comes along and says, okay, well, if the receiving and transmitting of information function of our neurons can be fulfilled by silicone chips, right? Because it's, again, not, it doesn't have to be a brain. If silicone chips were structured correctly and played that communication cause and effect role back and forth, it could be said to have a mind as well. Or if he says, if any other properly arranged material structure playing the relevant causal roles, that's all that matters here. What if we had a huge group of people, okay, China, for example, and they were organized to play the relevant roles of neurons, paralleling the interaction that goes on between them in the brain, for according to humans. They passed information back and forth, say, via a cell phone. They all had cell phones, okay? So that's how they communicated back and forth. Now, in the literature, this robot, they passed information back and forth. Now, if you had, let's say you attached a robot to it, via a radio transmitter, you attached him up to the Chinese nation here, and this robot has been called China Head. Okay, so that's what we'll call this robot. It's China Head. It's the robot is complex. Okay, it's built by a great scientist. It can receive information sent by the Chinese. Okay, so say the Chinese have all been given relevant roles or functions to play, such that if the robot gets kicked in the shin, this sends a signal up to a few hundred thousand Chinese. Okay, and then that few hundred thousand Chinese calls on their cell phone, relays information to another few hundred thousand Chinese. They receive the information, they relay that information to another few hundred thousand, and you follow this causal chain out. And eventually what happens here is the last group of Chinese that get the message, they send a signal down. They play the role of sending the signal back down to the robot, and he bends down and rubs his shin and cries, "Ouch." Okay? Now, that seems to be just like what the functionalist would consider the mind. They're playing the relevant causal roles, passing the information back and forth. But in none of this would there be anything like a feeling of pain. There would be no unified conscious experience of this pain. The qualia, which is a feature of the mind, which you can't deny, would be absent here. And so that's the Chinese argument. Another argument is called the zombie argument. And all these arguments, by the way, that I'm bringing up here are ones given by materialists, okay, and atheists. So I'm not pulling, this isn't some, you know, Christian apologetic book that we have that we're going off here. Basically, the zombie argument states that it's broadly logically conceivable that creatures known as zombies exist. Okay, these creatures, by definition, have no conscious experience. They do not exhibit qualia in the mind, then, but they do have a brain. So a zombie could exhibit the same behavioral, physical, and functional properties that we do. They have neurons, and they fire at a certain rate and go back and forth, and they have nerves and things like that. But there would be no subjective experience of pain at all. Just by definition, zombies don't aren't conscious. And so none of that, even though they had neural activity and the firing back and forth and those things playing those roles, there would be no qualia. It would be missing. That's something additional over and above anything physical. And the last argument I'll mention here is called the knowledge argument, developed by Frank Jackson. And this, simply put, this argument goes like this. Say at some point in the future, we have a completed physics such that we know all there is to know about everything in terms of the laws of physics. Okay? Now, say there's a girl named Mary. And Mary's raised in a black and white room. That's it. That's the only color room she's raised in is black and white. Say that, you know, her nose is plugged up and stuff like that, and her ears, so she can't smell anything or hear anything, and all she can see is stuff in black and white. Now, Mary is taught everything there is to know about the world in terms of a physical picture. Okay, so she knows everything there is to know about, say, colors, seeing colors. She knows that red is caused by light, you know, reflecting at 650 nanometers. This wavelength hits your optic nerves, in turn sending signals into your brain, activating such and such neurons, which fire at such and such rate. As well, she knows everything else there is to know about red and the experience of it, physically, as far as the physical laws goes. Okay, now after 40 years, say it takes 40 years to learn everything there is to know about that, about physics in, at this point in the future. She's released. Upon being released, Mary's given a shiny new red apple. She sees red for the first time. She now knows the quote-unquote what it is like to experience red. Okay, so this is what the knowledge argument concludes. It says, they say, there would seem to be then a new item of knowledge for her, right? But if it is new, and if she knew everything there was to know about physics, then it would appear that the subjective experience and the felt quality of seeing red is some new fact over and above facts of physics. So that would seem to be that physical facts can't be all there is to reality.
Okay. Right.
Now, this is a brief intro into all of this. And I by no means want to give the impression that there aren't responses to the above arguments, or even that I explain them in as robust a way as you could explain them. I just wanted to get the gist of them out there. So there's responses, there's counter-responses, and there's counter-counter-responses. I mean, just on the knowledge argument alone, there's tons of material. There's a book called There's Something About Mary, which is just articles directly related to Jackson's argument here. And same with the zombie literature and all sorts of stuff. So I'm not trying to say that now you have all you need to know. You can run out there and you'll be able to beat every materialist over the head with this stuff. Now, you still have to do your homework, but I hope the basic point I'm trying to draw has been made. So the literature also takes you to every field of philosophy pretty much as well when you study philosophy of mind. So there's a lot to take in here, but this is like something like an argument I would give against a materialist picture of the mind, and there are ones that I'll give later in the book as well as we progress in the review, but this one only applies to qualia, that subjective stuff I was talking about. My main point was to contrast the debate between the physicalist and the dualist in this regard, and to show what the physicalist picture of the mind looks like, and then to maintain that I do not think the physicalist can account for things like qualia, which I hope those arguments at least gave you an idea of why they can't. And so if they can't account for them, remember what I said earlier, what they have to do is eliminate them. If they can't be reduced down to the third person subjective realm, then you need to get rid of them. You don't use them in your naturalistic explanation. Now, I'm tying all this in together. You had to pay attention for a little while, but the point was Hitchens was trying to give a naturalistic explanation of why we like pigs.
Mm-hmm.
That's what he was trying to do. And I came in and said, Hitchens doesn't know what he's doing here. He's pretending to give a naturalistic explanation, but he doesn't know how to give one.
Mm-hmm.
And so you're probably, when you were hearing what I was saying, you're saying, what the heck does this have to do with Hitchens' comments about a pig? Okay, well, As I said, he shows then his ignorance of his own side of the debate. He pretends to be knowledgeable about scientific arguments and to be giving scientific explanations of events, but I maintain that he's not doing that. You see, he appealed to things like love and hate, porcophilia, porcophobia, or fear in his analysis. Those are qualia. Those are qualia. He appealed to things like propositional attitudes, right? Our beliefs about what pigs tasted like. That's a propositional attitude. That's what, again, in the literature they call your belief. So you were just using the word belief, but the philosophers call it your propositional attitude. These things, too, then, need to be given a naturalistic reducing. So we got to take the good old naturalistic hammer. Don't just take it to our view of why the Old Testament says you can't eat pig. Don't take it there, but take it to all this other stuff too. You know, why is Hitchens think that he can get off easy here? Mm-hmm. So let's apply your naturalistic chisel to everything else here in your explanation. Okay, so a complete naturalistic account of why the Old Testament forbids eating swine is because, well, there's certain neural firing patterns. Okay, C fibers firing at such and such rate. This has nothing to do with beliefs or desires about what pigs taste like, yeah, or anything like that. In fact, Hitchens should even be that appealing to these kinds of things, since that if they existed, they're irreducible to neurons, beliefs and desires and things like that. The neural structure would be the same regardless of the propositional content associated with it, with the neuron. Okay, so, for example, let me explain, give an explanation. An opera singer shatters a glass when she's saying 2 plus 2 equals 4 in a high C. Okay, when you give your naturalistic account of that, it's not to appeal at all to the propositional content of her singing. The glass would have shattered regardless if she had saying 2 plus 2 equals 4 or 2 plus 2 equals 5. Okay, the truth or falsity, the content, this immaterial content, does not function into your account, your naturalistic explanation of stuff. It's not even clear to me how Hitchens can explain how immaterial things, such as a propositional content, can cause things to happen in the physical world, such as telling people not to eat pig. Because that was an actual thing that happened in the world that Hitchens is trying to explain away. Well, how does belief cause things? Remember the causal principle I mentioned earlier? Well, if beliefs are immaterial, well, then how do they cause things to happen in the physical world? If they're not, then they're just these neural structures, and the neural structure has nothing to do with the propositional content, right? The belief that pig tastes bad or tastes like a human or sounds like a human when it's screaming. A complete naturalistic account doesn't refer to beliefs, religious or otherwise, then. Okay, so it's not that religion caused anything here. And it's not as if some feature of what they call folk psychology. Okay, Paul Churchland, atheist and a materialist, that's what he calls when you use terms like belief or, oh, I was happy, or, oh, I'm so mad at that guy. When you use terms like that, he calls that, you're just speaking according to folk psychology, and you need to eliminate those terms. So it would be something like, oh, my C fibers are firing at the rate of 500 miles an hour at that guy. Something like that. Hitchens can't use love and fear and those kind of things as our reason for not liking swine if he's going to be a consistent naturalist. So those things need to get naturalized too. When all this is said and done, though, do we have anything like a case against religion or religious belief? Religious belief doesn't cause anything. Neural patterns do. And those patterns seemingly would be the same with or without the attending propositional content, i.e., pigs taste like humans, they sound like humans when they scream, stuff like that. So a rigorous and consistent naturalizing of the facts destroys his case, in my opinion. So my point is to show that when Hitchens puffs out his chest and tries to bring out his big gun of a scientific reduction, he's acting like an ignoramus. He leaves almost his entire explanation in the realm of folk psychology, and a consistent application of his big gun would make the case look entirely different. And as I'll argue later on in the book, it makes much of his case unintelligible. And we could go further with this, but that's one of the points I want to draw out of this pig comment of his. Theological reasons are different as well, though. As an aside, though, notice that he offers no documentation for his claim about cannibalism as the cause of dietary laws. And that was in the Bible as well. I don't know what he's referring to. But the Bible claims that the reason for the laws were for the purpose of showing the separateness of God's people. And Hitchens unconsciously substantiates this in the chapter by his reference to how archaeologists know when they've found an Israelite community. It's by the absence of pig bones, he says. Okay, well, so even today, God's showing that his people are separate, even when they do archaeological digs, because they can see that the Israelite community was separate than the ones around them because of the absence of pig bones. And so the question, though, that we have, though, because that's the reason why, is for being separate. The question, though, is why certain specific animals? Well, much to Hitchens' surprise, theologians have already given a possible reason for the types of animals listed, as in their connection to people. So that's one of his point he was trying to make, is pigs look like people, and this has been a theological answer. Certain animals represented the Jews and others the Gentiles. And so it does have something to do with people, at least if we take some of these views are right. And so he might not be that far off from the truth, though the cannibalism part is a stretch. So his answer here, just about people, wouldn't contradict anything substantial in these theological analyses. And in the conservative introduction to the Pentateuch by Desmond Alexander, from Paradise to Promised Land, he notes that this view that it represented people is basically right. And he claims that for the Israelite, the animal world was structured as much the same way as the human world. Clean and unclean animals paralleled clean and unclean people, and with the classification within the classification of clean and unclean, there was also other classification, sacrificial, non-sacrificial. And this marked a distinction between people too, who were priests and people who were not. So the dietary laws were given, right after the laws separating priests from the people. They were set apart from the nation, the priests were, and then the nation was set apart from other nations. And these regulations would further inhibit Israelite ability to participate in eating meals with non-Israelites, thus achieving separateness. But we still want to know what's the rationale behind particular animals. A common feature that Alexander points out is that many of these animals are associated with death. They ate meat, and so death made you unclean. Even if you touched a clean animal that was dead, you would be unclean. So for the Israelite, death was associated with being unclean, and many of these animals ate meat. And another insider position is that of Gordon Wenham, a scholar, Old Testament scholar, who points out that holiness means more than just separateness. It also means wholeness or completeness. And so animals that seem to confuse kinds then are classified as unclean. So fish should have scales normally, and so when you don't have scales, you're mixing kinds. And so he would say that's where you got some of your dietary laws from. Well, regardless of which view we take here, Hitchens' analysis is totally unsatisfactory. Okay, Hitchens, proud science-loving atheist that he is, fails to give a good scientific explanation of anything in terms of explanatory power. Here's why. There were many other animals besides the pig that were considered unclean. His analysis would fail to explain their inclusion into the category of unclean animals. He claims children normally like pigs without rabbis telling them that they're dirty. Well, they also like rabbits, too. But those were unclean. So Hitchens fails to explain why the Israelites forbid pig, but no one else did. Why, if it was because we thought we hated pig because they sounded like humans, but we loved them too because they look like humans. Well, why didn't everyone have this sort of thing going on? So he can't account for that either. Why, if it reminds one of humans, did not all the other nations not partake of it? So it just seems odd that the Israelites and the Israelites alone would have exhibited this subconscious or unconscious trait. And it also fails to account for the New Testament lifting the ban. You know, from one day to the next, you go from not eating pig because it subconsciously reminds you of humans, and the next day just going ahead and doing it. His view simply lacks explanatory value. It lacks the mark of a scientific analysis. I'm answering him on his own terms. and he can't even give answers being as a scientist that he's trying to be. It's insufficient as an explanation besides the problems I, you know, listed earlier in regards to naturalism and the philosophy of mind and things like that. So he has, his answer is totally unsatisfactory for why the Israelites had the dietary laws that, that they did, and I would maintain that, that my view has more explanatory value.
Mm-hmm. I think we should go out to Red Lobster after this.
I am hungry.
Yeah, so that brings us to the conclusion of our first hour, and we're going to go ahead and go for a second hour after we take a break, but I do want to mention that Bruce Buchanan from Central Lake, Michigan, wrote in, and he answered my little problem at the beginning. And the jingle is, if you've got the time, we've got the beer. And that's Miller Beer.
How did you forget that jingle?
Well, I don't drink Miller Beer, first of all, but, but there was a commercial. They had a jingle that went with it.
Yes.
And it's amazing to me how these types of... these types of commercials and jingles stick in your head years and years after the fact. I don't know, that was probably something that I know they were probably playing in the 70s or 80s and stuck in my head. So when I said, if you've got the time, speaking of 2 hours with us today, there was like a part of my brain that said, well, wait a minute, that's a jingle. There's another part that goes with that. That's funny. Yeah. At least it is to me.
Oh, hey, well, I'm gonna be seeing Bruce here pretty soon, hopefully. So.
Are you?
Well, he's out there in Michigan.
Oh, that's right.
Michigan.
Oh, yeah.
So we'll finally get a chance to hang out, maybe knock back a few Miller beers.
So Bruce wins a one-year subscription, free subscription to the Narrow Mind Archive. So, Bruce, what I need you to do is send me your username that you've registered with at the website, and I'll hook you up. All right, we're going to take a quick break, folks. We're going to be back with it. Why don't you give us a preview? What are we going to be talking about in the second hour, Paul?
It's his chapter on why religion is bad and dangerous for your health.
Oh,
gotta stay tuned
for that. Stay tuned. That's right. All right, we'll be right back, folks. Listen to The Narrow Mind. And this is part one of two today on Saturday.
Do you know what day it is?
July 12th.
The 12th.
July 12th, 2008. We'll be right back.
Narrow Mind with Pastor Gene Cook Jr. Love him or hate him, you're still listening to him.